So my goal for this course is that after learning this material, you'll never need to consult a handbook of special functions again. Well, not really. They're very useful materials. You should consult them whenever you need to learn more about a specific special function. My goal really is to tell you about the techniques that are available for manipulating special functions. And I've focused on things that will have applications to other courses later in the year, particularly the quantum field theory courses. So some of the things I'm going to tell you about are somewhat loosely connected to special functions, but I've chosen them so that they hopefully will be useful to you later in the year. So an outline of the course. So we'll spend today and part of tomorrow discussing distributions, which are a generalization of the notion of function. One example of a distribution that's not a function that you're familiar with is the Dirac delta function. So we'll be discussing that in some detail. And for the rest of tomorrow's lecture, we will discuss the gamma and zeta functions on the complex plane, which will have some applications to quantum field theory that I'll allude to tomorrow, and you'll discuss more in the tutorial. On Thursday, we will discuss orthogonal functions. And how they arise, why we need to use them as solutions to differential equations and some of the tools we have for manipulating them. And finally, on Friday, we'll discuss asymptotic series and methods for approximating integrals. Such as the saddle point approximation, which we will be using in quantum field theory. Okay. So that's where we're going. All right. Today's topic is distributions. So why do we need to study distributions? So one example is if we want to study a point charge, the charge density, if the point charge is located at the origin, is just 0 when x is not equal to 0 and infinity x equals 0, such that the integral of the charge density over space is equal to the charge of the particle. So this is not a function. It doesn't have a well-defined value at zero. And that can cause problems we need to be careful when we're manipulating objects like this that don't have well-defined values everywhere. And I'll explain over today's lecture some of the things that can go wrong if we think about rho as a function. So it's not a function because it has no well-defined value at zero. Other reasons we need to learn about distributions. So you're probably familiar to some extent with dealing with delta functions, but there are some other applications that may be less familiar to you. So we will run across expressions like the nth derivative, not precisely these expressions, but things that are in principle similar, nth derivative of the absolute value of x at x equals 0, or the integral over the real line of 1 over x dx. So these expressions are, it's not immediately obvious how to make sense of them. X, the derivative of x is not smooth at 0. So it's not immediately obvious how to make sense of this expression. We'd like to say that this is 0. The integrand is odd. But at x equals 0, it blows up. So we need to be, in some cases, we might need to be more careful if we run into expressions like this. And we will run into expressions that are very similar to this in quantum field theory. Another reason we might need to study distributions is when we want to take limits of sequences of functions. So as we'll see, the limit of a sequence of functions, even if it converges, is not always a function. And so things don't always behave exactly like you'd expect. Finally, distributions arise in variational problems of the type you've already seen in David's course last week. So, the most important example is the Dirac delta function. As I've already explained, it's not a function because it has no well-defined value at 0. So it's usually defined, and I'm going to put this equality sign in quotes. This is not the way we're going to define it, as being equal to some function that's the limit of a sequence of functions. So limit as sigma goes to 0 of a sequence of functions f sigma of x, where, for instance, f sigma could be equal to 1 over sigma if the absolute value of x is less than sigma over 2, and 0 otherwise. So this, all of the elements of this sequence have the property that they're integral over the real line is 1. So we'd expect that the limit has the same property, and it's also the limiting function should be 0 away from 0. So it intuitively, this seems like it should work. But there are some problems that I'll explain in later in the lecture. Okay. So before I explain what the problems with this definition are, I need to give you some definitions. So we'll see later when do we have to be careful. So first concept we'll need is a function space. So a function space is a vector space whose elements are, and I'm intentionally leaving some blank space here, functions that have a norm and has a norm, which satisfies the usual properties. Of vector space, so those properties are positivity, which means that for every function in the vector space, in our function space, the norm should be greater than or equal to zero, and the only function that should have zero norm should be the zero function. The additive identity. So we can think of function spaces like infinite dimensional vector spaces, where the dimension just counts the value of the function at each point. This is not a precise analogy. Infinite dimensional vector spaces behave a bit differently from finite dimensional vector spaces that you're used to, but it's a useful analogy. The norm also satisfies the triangle inequality. So that means the norm of f plus g should be less than or equal to the norm of f plus the norm of g. And linear homogeneity, which means that the norm of lambda f should be equal to the absolute value of lambda times the norm of f, where lambda is some real number or complex number. Okay. So we'll mostly be interested in function spaces that are also inner product spaces. So an inner product space means that the norm comes from an inner product. And we'll exclusively be interested in the inner product that is familiar to you from quantum mechanics, which is just the integral of f star g dx. And so the norm, it comes from the inner product, is just the same as it is in a finite dimensional vector space. The norm is just the root of the inner product of the function with itself. Okay. And so this norm defines the space L2, so this is the space of square integrable functions on the interval AB. Now, we need to check that this satisfies our definitions of a function space. So let's look at two functions that are in L2 of, say, minus infinity and infinity. We can look at two functions. So let's just look at a very simple function, the zero function. So that trivially has zero norm. We're going to also look at another function, f2. And let's say f2 is equal to 0 when x is not equal to 1, and pi if x equals 1. So this function also has zero norm. So is this consistent with our definition of a function space?
No.
No. So that's why I left a blank here. We need to identify these functions in order to make L2 a function space. So the our definition is going to be a function space is a vector space whose elements are equivalence classes. Of functions. So we want to identify f1 and f2. So these are the same element of our vector space. So f1 equals f2. Okay. Now, this space is not general enough still to contain the delta function. So we've generalized beyond vector spaces whose elements are functions to vector spaces whose elements are equivalence classes of functions, but we still don't have a space in which the delta function is an element. To see that, let's calculate the norm of our functions f sigma. And so the norm of f sigma is just the integral from minus sigma over 2 to sigma over 2, 1 over sigma squared dx, because it's 0 outside of this range. And this is just 1 over sigma. And so f, which is the limit of f sigma as sigma goes to 0, is undefined. This tells us that f, the norm of f, is infinity or undefined. So it doesn't have a finite norm, so it's not an element of L2. Yes.
I have a question about the equivalence classes. So just in general, are two functions equivalent if they're the same at all but a finite number of points?
That's right. Okay. So they would have the same norm and that same inner product with all their functions. Another way to see that is that we could add something in the equivalence class of the additive identity, such as f1 and f2 up there. To a function, to any function, and so if we're adding that, instead of just modifying the function at one point, we can modify it at a finite number of points, and we still.
So they have the same norm and they have the same inner product.
Same inner product.
So same in every important property.
That's right. Yeah.
And so that's kind of why you can get the Dirac delta function, because any function that's zero at all except a single point has to be zero in L2.
That's right. That's right. That's another way of seeing it. Okay. So we need to be careful sometimes when we're. So I claim that there's some problems about thinking about the delta function like this. We need to be careful sometimes. And to see that, let's choose a sequence. G sigma, which goes to some function g, which we'll say is equal, in quotes, to the delta function, which satisfies the same properties as before, and one additional property, So G sigma of x is 0. For x not equal to 0. And its integral is 1 for all sigma greater than 0. So these two properties are satisfied by f, but we're going to also demand one other property, which is that we can fit the g sigmas in some boxes. So let's, so if g sigma goes to g, which approaches the delta function, we'd expect that the g sigmas become more and more peaked near 0 as we take sigma to 0. So it's reasonable to constrain the g sigmas to lie in boxes of height 1 and width epsilon. And we can stack an infinite series of increasingly narrow blocks on top of this. So this make the second block of width epsilon over 2, and the third one, again, of height 1, and width epsilon over 4. And what we want to demand is that for each epsilon, we can find a sigma naught so that g sigma lies in the boxes for all sigma less than sigma naught. So our f satisfied, our f that we looked at before satisfies these properties, but we can come up with more general examples too. So as we take the limit as g sigma goes to 0, as epsilon goes to 0, this becomes more and more peaked near 0. Sorry, I didn't
Does
hear
the
that.
Area of those boxes goes to 0 when epsilon goes to 0?
Yes, that's, I was just to say that, but very good. That's entirely correct. That was my next point, yes. So as epsilon goes to 0, the area of these boxes goes to 0. And to see that, G lies inside the boxes. So G should be less than the area, so the integral of G of x dx should be less than the area of the boxes. Okay. So the area of the boxes is just epsilon plus epsilon over 2 plus epsilon over 4, et cetera, which is, if we sum this series, we get 2 epsilon. So this has to be true for any epsilon. Which, as was pointed out, means that the integral of g of x dx equals 0, which is not what we wanted. We wanted this to be equal to the limit as sigma goes to 0 of the integral of g sigma of x dx. So what we've done basically is when we switch the limits of integration and taking the limit, we changed our answer. So the order matters here. Another way of stating the problem that we've just discovered is that pointwise convergence so converging at each value of the function is not the same as converging with respect to the L2 norm. So how can we come up with a proper definition of delta that's not going to lead us into any traps like this? To do that, we're going to need to introduce a few new concepts and definitions. And so the problem here, yes?
Sorry, when you write for sigma less than sigma naught, do you mean the like, shouldn't it be for sigma greater than sigma naught?
So the G sigma goes to G when sigma goes to zero, not to infinity. So I've just defined it that way if I did the limit the other way.
That makes sense.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yes. Sorry, I just want to check. Did you say that F sigma you defined before fits inside those boxes for all epsilon?
For each epsilon, we can find a value of sigma so that it could fit inside the boxes.
That can't be correct, because when epsilon is less than, you know, you just find the area of all those boxes and it's to epsilon. And we know that, like, for all finite sigma, the integral of that function is 1. So when epsilon is less than a half, you can't do that.
So this
might be different, yeah.
Okay. The integral of g sigma is 1,
right?
For all sigma greater than 0.
Yeah.
That doesn't tell us that the integral of g sigma is 1 for sigma equals 0. That's why this is surprising.
Yeah.
But what he's saying that if you take epsilon for less than half, when you claim that there is some G sigma, not G zero, G sigma, that mm-hmm. fits inside, and how can its integral be 1?
That's always claiming.
Oh, Oh, maybe.
Yeah,
this one. This f may. Yeah, I see what you're saying. This f may not go to infinity fast enough. You might need something that's more sharply peaked. But there do exist. We could come up with another limit that would do this. Oh, yeah, sorry about that.
That's all right.
Yeah. Okay. So, the problem. Basically came when we tried to think about delta as a function. We haven't found any problems when we just keep delta inside of an integral like we usually do. So so delta behaves nicely under integrals. At least we haven't come up with any examples where it doesn't. So let's try to generalize that concept. So an integral is a map from a function to the real numbers or complex numbers, so it's a functional. Let's take that idea and try to generalize it and see if we can come up with a careful definition of what the delta function is. So first, let's think about which functions we want our functional to act on. And these are what are known as test functions. So we can choose different test function spaces. I'll denote the test function space as a curly D. So this is the test function space. And I'm going to choose D to be the set of continuous and infinitely differentiable functions. With compact support. So compact support means that it vanishes outside of a finite interval. So most of what I'm going to say is not going to depend very much on this choice. In particular, instead of compact support, most of what I'll say would hold if we just demanded that the functions go to zero faster than any polynomial at plus or minus infinity. I don't need infinitely many derivatives most of the time. One or two would be sufficient.
Don't you need inverse of any polynomial as you go to zero faster than
any? And then x to the n for any n. Where n can be positive or negative. Yeah. But this choice will make things simple. So, and I'll restrict my attention to real valued functions too. Much of it will hold for complex valued functions as well. So this is a vector space. When we equip it with the same L2 norm. So we can define a dual vector space D star of linear functionals from D to R. And so what this means is that U is going to be a functional in this dual vector space if U of phi is a real number, a finite real number, for any test function phi in our test function space. Okay. Yes.
Sorry, I've got kind of two questions. When you say vanishes off of a finite interval, you mean equals zero off a finite interval?
That's exactly what I mean.
Can you give an example of a smooth function that vanishes off a finite
interval? Very good question, yes. So for example, e to the minus 1 over 1 minus x squared for x, absolute value of x less than 1, and 0 otherwise. So this is an example of a test function. The greater the restrictions we place on the test functions, the wider the class of distributions we'll get. So this is a very this is a strong restrictions on our functions. But this satisfied them. So at plus and minus 1, e to the minus 1 over 1 minus x squared is 0, and so are all of its derivatives. So it satisfies properties.
And it's 0 if the absolute value of x is greater than or equal to
1. Oh, 1, yes, thank you. So this is one example. Okay. So we define a dual vector space, and the space of distributions is the largest continuous dual space. So D prime is the space of distributions. Is the largest continuous dual space. And by continuous, I mean that if a sequence of test functions converges with respect to the norm to a test function phi, then we should have that u of phi n converges to u of phi.
So is D prime a subset of D star?
So D star, we could define many different linear spaces of linear functionals. So we could define a trivial D star that just maps everything to, say, 0.
Is D star the set of all linear functionals? Being like the dual vector space?
Oh, sorry, yeah. How do I define it?
A dual vector.
Yeah, so if it's a dual vector space, then yeah, it's. Well, we can define different dual vector spaces depending on. So the dual vector space just means we have to have a set of functionals that are linear and are maps to R. So we could define just a trivial set that just has a single element. But D star is a particular dual space. It's the largest continuous dual space. So yes?
When you got convergence there, that convergence is norm or
more? Yes, this is convergence with respect to the L2 norm. The norm, sorry. Norm.
And is D prime unique?
D prime is unique, yes.
And are we saying every D star lies within D is a subset of D prime? Or
a D? So we're putting this one restriction, continuity. So we could come up with discontinuous D stars. Okay. So the three properties that you need to have if it's going to be an element of D stars, it needs to be continuous. So if U is a distribution, then it needs to be continuous. It needs to be linear, in the sense that U of lambda phi plus mu psi equals lambda u phi plus mu u of psi, where lambda and mu are real numbers and phi and psi are test functions. And it needs to be finite. That means that u of phi needs to be a real number for all phi. So the space of distributions is the set of all u that satisfy these three properties. Okay, so just a word on notation. So I've been using this notation. Let's look at an example, delta, which is a particular distribution. Delta of phi is equal to phi of 0. I'm often going to write, and you often see this notation. Which is slightly imprecise in the sense that delta of 0 doesn't really make sense, but you should just think of it as meaning this particular map. But this will give us some good intuition. In some of the references I posted on the wiki, you'll see this pairing notation. So this is probably more commonly used than this functional notation that I'm using. This is a pairing notation. I don't like this because it suggests an inner product. There's no inner product here. Okay. Can anyone give me an example of a distribution that, besides the delta function? Heaviside? Yeah, there's simpler examples.
Any function in your space?
That's right. So any function that's locally integrable. So that's all we need. So you know many examples of functions, of distributions. Sorry.
Why isn't that an inner product? What's like one?
They live in different spaces. These two up. So. Delta, the distributions live in one space, and the test functions live in a different space. So when we define an inner product, it's always between elements of the same space.
There's a natural projection, right?
There is a natural projection. So it's...
you could look at phi as an element of... as a distribution as well.
That's right. Yeah. We can do that. We can define inner product between phi and itself easily, but between distributions, the product of distributions is in general not well defined. Yes, I'll talk about that more later. Okay. So. See if you're following. Let's look at a few examples of ways we could try to define distributions. So which of these are distributions? First one isn't, why not?
It's not linear.
Right, so this is not linear. How about the second one? Yes, I mean the nth derivative here. Yes, this is. So this is linear, continuous, and finite. Note that if I extended this integral to infinity, we wouldn't necessarily have that this is finite. So the fact that this is a finite sum is important. So this is a distribution. OK. That's what distributions are. And any questions on?
Sorry, I was wondering about notation on the left-hand side of the board. So you're saying that like when we talk about a distribution acting on a function, and you're saying we just say that the equivalent notation is equal to a delta.
The system has detected that a minimum number of lines are connected to this conference.
Yes.
Do you want to continue your meeting? Press 1 to confirm.
So
if there is no response, the conference will end.
Okay. This notation is going to be useful to us because it because of the fact that many distributions are also functions.
Right.
So we're going to when we define operations on distributions, we'll take inspiration from the fact that we know how to manipulate distributions that are functions, and that will suggest ways that we can generalize operations we perform on normal functions to distributions that aren't functions.
So is the integral the only representation of the bearing, or is there in principle other ways?
So these these are all meant to represent the same thing. It's just different notation.
I mean, in general, is the integral the only way to represent the pairing between a distribution and a function?
No, it's not. That's the main way we'll be interested in, but there are more general ways. Okay. So. One of the first things we might want to do is take a derivative of a distribution. We take derivatives of functions all the time. And it'd be useful to take derivatives of distributions. Okay. So the way we usually define derivatives is just the usual limiting procedure. Does this work for distributions? I heard someone say no. And that's correct. We can't really make sense of this because, in general, we can't make sense of U of X for a distribution. So that doesn't work. So. Need to try something else. So let's look at expression for u prime of phi. will be interested in the case, we can write it as an integral. And if U is a distribution that's also a function, we know what to do. We can integrate by parts. So let's do that and see what happens. So this is okay only if U is a function. Okay. Now, because of the way we've chosen our test functions, we can say something about this first term.
It vanishes.
That's right. So U, we don't know anything about U, but we know that phi vanishes identically outside of a finite region. So in particular, it's 0 at plus and minus infinity, and it's identically 0 in the large x and large negative x regions. So this is 0. So get this is equal to minus the integral U of x, phi prime of x, dx. Which if we go back to our pairing notation, is just that U prime of phi is equal to minus U of phi prime. And we'll take this as a definition. And similarly, if we want to take the nth derivative, we can make the same sort of argument, or just repeatedly apply this, and we get that the nth derivative of a distribution is minus 1 to the n times u of the nth derivative of the test function. We'll take this as a definition. And this is, so this only makes sense if we can take n derivatives, which is why I chose our test function space to be C infinity functions. Yes.
Can you explain again how can U be a function?
So for example, if I choose U
how do you define where it's
right. So what, more precisely, what I mean it would be U would be, we could say that U acting on phi would be the integral of, could be the integral of, say, some function f phi of x dx. And so I, somewhat imprecisely, I've been saying U is this function. It's really the convolution weighted with a locally integrable function. So that's what I mean by that.
So let's go over your technical definition again, because I mean we know that not all genes have that functional. That, like, for example, direct delta doesn't have a function. We should do that.
That's right. So this is a particular example of use. So this is what I meant when I said that. Meant by U is a locally integrable function. which I've said several times, but that's a slightly imprecise statement. What I really meant was U is the integral. U acts on a test function by integrating the test function against a locally integrable function, which is a mouthful. So I've just said U is a locally integrable function.
Then are we generalizing the result of the derivative to all kind of distributions or only to the ones when U is a function?
So this was inspiration. We're going to take this as a definition.
Okay.
We can't derive this for the examples of U that can't be written in this way. Some U's cannot be written like this. But we're going to take this as a definition for all U. Okay, so let's look at some examples to see how this works. First, a more familiar one, and then a more exotic one. So, as I mentioned earlier, the Heaviside function, which is a distribution. So the Heaviside function is just 1 if x is positive and 0 otherwise. And theta defines a distribution because if we integrate theta of x against any test function, we just get the integral from 0 to infinity of the test function. And this satisfies our three properties of a distribution. First of all, it's finite because phi has a finite range and is finite everywhere. So this is finite. It's continuous and linear, manifestly. Okay, and let's just check that our definition of the derivative of a distribution, which is also known as a weak derivative or a distributional derivative, gives us the answer we expect. So theta prime of phi is defined to be theta minus theta of phi prime, which is equal to minus the integral of theta, minus, so this is our definition of the way theta acts on a test function. So it's the integral from 0 to infinity of phi prime of x dx. And we can integrate this directly and get minus phi of infinity minus phi of 0. But this is 0 because phi has compact support. So this is just equal to phi of 0, which is just the way we defined the delta function to act on a test function. So this tells us that theta prime equals delta. Because if we act with either of these distributions on any test function, we get the same answer. So these are equal. That's just what we'd expect. So let's look at a less familiar example. Okay. So let's try to define the natural log of the absolute value of x as a distribution. And we want to, what we'll want to do is compute its weak derivative. Okay, so how can we define the natural log of the absolute value of x act on a test function? So I've written the derivative here, so that just gives us a minus sign and a derivative on phi. What we'd like to do, based on analogies with the Heaviside function, is just define this to be phi prime of x times the natural log of the absolute value of x dx. Does this definition work?
Log is going to diverge at
0. Right, so this diverges at 0, and we don't know anything about phi prime at 0. So this is not necessarily a well-defined integral. Doesn't converge near. So we need to come up with a different definition. And one way we can get around this problem is just to excise the region around 0 from our integral. So we can write this as the limit. Define this to be the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of the same integral with a region of width 2 epsilon cut away. So now this integral then is always finite for any epsilon. So we can take this as a definition, and we'll always get a finite number.
How do we know the limit exists if epsilon goes to 0?
How do we know it exists? So well, we need to check that. That's something we need to check. And yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that in a minute. So if we take this as a definition, we can integrate by parts. And what we get is just 1 over x. 5x, and we get boundary terms at only at minus epsilon and epsilon. Our boundary terms at plus and minus infinity vanish for the same reason. Minus x.
Should there be a minus sign on one of those two integrals?
Let's see. So for derivative of, we have an absolute value here.
That's the thing. Because like when x is less than zero, you've got the log of negative x.
Okay. Minus sign here. Yeah. And so then we need to worry about these terms. We can write these terms here as the natural log of epsilon times phi of epsilon minus phi of minus epsilon, which is approximately equal to the natural log of epsilon times the derivative of phi at 0 times 2 epsilon, if epsilon is small. So we have here, if we want to take the limit as epsilon goes to 0, we've got the limit of epsilon times log of absolute value of epsilon, which goes to 0 as epsilon goes to 0. So this term disappears. And what we're left with is limit as epsilon goes to 0 of, I think this should be a plus sign. It was, so we get a minus infinity to minus epsilon, integral to epsilon to infinity of 1 over x, 5x, dx. And so this result is what's known as the principal value of 1 over x distribution acting on phi. So, remember from the beginning of lecture, I said that using distributions, we can make sense of integrals of things like 1 over x. And one way to do that is using the principal value distribution, which is defined like this. It's closely related to the I epsilon distribution that we'll be using in QFT courses, and we'll see that connection in tutorial tomorrow. So this is one way that we can make sense of integrals that naively don't make sense or give divergent answers. Any questions about that? Yes?
On the second line, set if actually, never mind.
Okay.
Figure it out.
Yes?
So here you calculated the derivative of ln of absolute value of x.
Yes.
But was it is it a well-defined distribution to start with for us to be able to take the derivative?
If we define it this way. Not if we define it this way. This doesn't work. Yes?
I figured out my question again. So let's say phi prime was constant through the origin.
Mm-hmm.
So phi is just a line or something. So on the second line, how does that converge? It's basically the integral of log absolute x. And I realize you're taking epsilon, you're breaking it off, but how is that limit different than just the integral in the first place?
Is that, yeah, no.
Sorry.
So if we if we get rid of this?
Yeah. Those two terms both look like positive.
So those two terms, but the example you gave is not a good test function because it doesn't have compact support.
Well,
one
of the order and then taper off.
And taper off, right.
Yeah. Taper off somewhere else because we're only concerned with the pathology of the origin.
So then we would have, we could write using the symmetry, we could write this as 2 times the integral from epsilon to infinity of the log of x.
Mm-hmm. And then as epsilon goes to 0, that goes to infinity.
Right.
Yeah, it's 1 over x.
1 over x.
Is it x1? No, it's x log x1.
Yeah, so that's okay.
Yeah,
it's the we would have a problem at infinity if we didn't have it go to 0. Any other questions?
I gotta check with the thing you define as a principal value. You've got if I take say a function that's non-zero at x equals 0, and I do that integral, is that not sort of if I just have a function, if I just have, say, the one you did before, which is e to the 1 minus 1 over 1 minus x squared,
mm-hmm.
and that's non-zero to x equals 0. If I integrate this thing here, I don't think I'm going to get 0. So I'm going to have something that's non-zero at 0 times by 1 over x. Something non-zero at 0 times by 1 over epsilon, and then I'm taking epsilon goes to 0. So wouldn't that go to...
No, it should give you a finite number. We'll actually show that in tutorial tomorrow.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay, so looks like we're basically out of time. Tomorrow we'll wrap up our discussion of distributions. I'll talk about multiplication of distributions with functions, composition, and some applications to functional derivatives. And then we'll begin and finish our discussion of gamma and zeta functions.